seeing in it a comforting reflection of his own acedia. That wouldn't have been too fanciful. It would have been like my own wish coming to the cottage in his grounds not to interfere, to take things as I found them, and then my later wish, out of my own delight in the place, not to see decay, not to be saddened by that too ready idea of decay, to see instead flux, constant change, and the feeling which I grew to cherish that in the very dereliction of the grounds I had come upon them at their peak, that the order created by 16 gardeners would have been too much, would have made for strain and anxiety, that the true beauty of the place lay in accidental, unintended things, the peonies coming out very slowly below the thick, dark green of the yews, the single blue iris among the tall nettles, the young deer that for many months lived among the reeds beside the rotting bridges over the water channels, having learned that the place was not frequented by men. I had come to the manor in a mood of withdrawal, myself, and I understood how in that mood one would have felt mocked. It would have debilitated one to make gestures that were too affirmative. As part of that wish to be unaffirmative, to take things as I found them, not to interfere, I had painted my room in the cottage a deep mauve. It was the least assertive colour I could think of, and it came from something in my childhood. My elementary school in Port of Spain was in a street, Victoria Avenue, that ended in a cemetery. Nearly every afternoon after school I saw the horse-drawn hearses and the mourning procession on foot, passing the high, rubble-filled wall of the cemetery, named La Pérouse, after the French explorer La Pérouse, by our late 18th-century French settlers, fleeing the effects of the French Revolution in Haiti and the other French islands. The horses that pulled the hearses to La Pérouse were covered with a reticulated pall, black or mauve. As a result, mauve, purple, was never for me the colour of power and pomp, it was the colour of death. In the mood I was in when I came to the cottage, any more affirmative, life-encouraging colour would have been only mocking. Later that colour became associated with the beauty and benignity and welcome of the place. And since one seeks to understand people by looking for aspects of oneself in them, I was willing to attribute something of the attitudes of my own withdrawal to my landlord. But perhaps there was as little pattern in his emotions, his sensual responses, as in his poems. He liked summer, the sun, flowers, ivy. Perhaps he was incapable of any effort to put things right. Or perhaps he was merely spoilt, and thought that however much the ivy and the gales destroyed in his garden, there would still be something for him to see. There would still be some sunshine in the summer, and some clearing in the ruined garden for him to sit out in. Ivy, so covered and smothered some trees, it was hard, especially for me who knew so little, to tell what kinds of trees they were. A tree that collapsed one year turned out to be a cherry tree. I had known it only for its fitful blossom breaking through the ivy matting. Pitten and Mr. Phillips between them cut up the cherry trunk into discs. They used a chainsaw, and the discs were perfect little things like toys when freed of the ivy matting. I was offered some of the discs for my fire. I put the discs I had been given in my outbuilding, a half-cottage against the vegetable garden wall, and left them there to dry. When they did dry out, I couldn't bring myself to burn them all. One disc I kept as a souvenir of the garden, and I had it smoothed down and varnished. It had dried with its sheeny bark on. There were only a few spaces between the bark and the wood, and drying as slowly as it had done, the wood had hardly cracked, just showing saw marks and nondescript as wood without a definite colour. Growing dusty in my outbuilding, the cherry wood disc came up beautifully when it was smoothed down. I counted the rings. There were 47. For its first 2 or 3 years the cherry tree might have grown in a nursery, so it might have been planted in the autumn of 1930. For the first 26 years the sapwood had grown at a healthy pace, and the colour of the wood at the centre was blonde, but then for its last 21 years the growth of the sapwood had slowed down, the lines of the heartwood had grown close together, and the outer wood of the disc was dark. Here, in the secret vegetable life of the cherry tree of the garden, was something like confirmation of what I had heard about the life of my landlord. In 1949, or 1950 being the year I had left my own home island, had made my roundabout journey to England looking for material to write about, and being, as a writer, in the pieces I attempted, much more knowledgeable than I was as a person, hiding myself from my true experience, hiding my experience from myself. In 1949 or 1950, my landlord had withdrawn from the world out of an excess of knowledge of that world. That probably was when he had given orders that the ivy was not to be touched. Up to that time, the garden laid out by his parents had been more or less tended, in spite of everything, in spite of the war. 4 or 5 years later, going by the evidence of the rings on my disc of cherry wood, the ivy had taken. And 21 years after that, the choked, strangled tree had collapsed and become part of the debris of the garden, the debris of a life. It occurred to me one day that at the time the ivy had taken or become established on the cherry tree, at the time my landlord's acedia had become permanent, while he was still a youngish man, I would have left Oxford. And since I had to do something, and since I had left home to be a writer, and no other talent or vocation had declared itself in me, I had set myself up as a writer, as deliberately as that. And there was no joy in that decision. That was the blankest and most frightening year of my life. And one day, in the valley, for no reason, perhaps only for the sake of the thrill, as I was walking up the hill beside the windbreak of pine and beech and hawthorn and field roses to the viewing point, walking in that setting which had given me joy of place like no other place in the world, I found myself thinking myself back into my personality of 25 years before, and felt again a panic I had all but forgotten, and the wish it had given rise to run and hide. Having no money, no job, having developed no talent, having no place to return to that evening except a dark and very damp basement flat rented by a cousin. Having nothing to offer my family, who, since the death of my father the previous year, were psychologically dependent on me. Somehow I had done the writing. Somehow, and 20 years later it was to seem such a piece of luck, I had engaged myself in the world. And 20 years of a life which had been the opposite of my landlord's had brought me to the solace of the debris of his garden, the debris of his own life. Debris which, nonetheless, never ceased to have an element of grandeur. A man with a simpler idea of himself, a simpler idea of his name, would have seen the great value of his property, might have realized its value, and lived elegantly elsewhere on the proceeds. But my landlord preferred to be with what he knew. Other people might contemplate a move for him. He himself could not think of a life away from his house and garden, which perhaps he continued to see in his own way. Perhaps even saw as whole and perfect, the way we fail to see the tarnishing that has gradually come to flats or houses where we have lived a long time. The manor seemed so much itself, the style of things there so established, that the recentness of the decay was a surprise. And having learned to see that, I saw it in other places as well. I saw it in the cold frames just outside my cottage. These frames, intended as little nurseries, had low walls of brick, with the northern wall a foot or two higher than the southern, and they were roofed with great timber-framed glass covers, hinged to the higher northern wall, so that the glass covers sloped south. These covers could not have been easy to lift. Like many other things in the manor grounds, they had been over-specified, heavy glass, over-solid timber frames. At some stage the cold frames had been abandoned, and the heavy covers, taken off their hinges, had been set against the high vegetable garden wall. That was where I found them. They looked very old, with the weeds and grass growing around them, but when in the summer, going beyond what was strictly my own territory and cutting the grass between my back door and the garden wall, with the manor's mower, filled by Pitten with the manor's fuel, when in the summer I first cut that grass and took the mower right up to the garden wall and the glass covers, what a transformation! What had looked like bush in a long-neglected corner of the grounds came up, after its cut, looking level and neat, and it was as if the glass covers had been set against the wall just a few months before. The earth there, against the wall, had been made up partly of wood ash and reddish coal ash, perhaps even from the fireplaces of my own cottage, and perhaps before the days of refuge. Between this made-up earth and the side wall of my outbuilding there was a depression with a bulky metal grill, a soakaway, one of many set about the grounds to drain the water that ran off the downs, the road, the paved lane, the lawn, the drive. Nothing was natural here. Everything was considered. Grass and trees concealed as much engineering as a Roman forum. Just one cut with the mower did away with the idea of wilderness outside the back door of my cottage, showed up the considered lines of wall and earth and outbuilding, and the solidity of the timber-framed glass covers against the wall. Still firm, the timber of those covers, still showing white paint. Few of the glass panes had broken. Four or five had merely slipped from their cracked patios, and although the soil was poor and was on the north side of the garden wall and for much of the day was in the shade of the beech trees, yet the grass and weeds that grew between the glass covers had grown unnaturally tall and rich, and though in the brick-walled frames themselves, still edged with timber to receive the glass covers, there were drifts of beech leaves and beech mast, and out of the oddly yellow sand there grew nettles and ground elder and weeds whose names I didn't know, and many thorny blackberry bushes, yet that one cut with the mower around the cold frame did away with the idea of old decay, as 5 or 6 years later the rings in the disk of the collapsed cherry tree were also to do. It was oddly unsettling to see the ground at the back of my cottage come up again, unsettling to deal with the idea that the dereliction of the place was new. The dereliction which to me had made it perfect as a place of refuge, and in which I had taken such comfort, that the place had been let go just a year or two before I had arrived, that the process of contraction, though begun 20 or 25 years before, had recently accelerated, and that my own presence there was part of that accelerating process. And the Phillipses, too, when I had first met them, they had seemed to belong, to be part of their setting, to have been moulded by the neglect by which they were surrounded. I had sat in their sitting-room and looked out onto the mottled stone terrace, with its views of the untended gardens, the big trees, the overgrown water-meadows obscuring everything beyond, the branches of shrubs in the foreground now hung with seed-bells for the birds, and to one side empty washing-lines with a supporting pronged pole. All that had seemed of a piece with the manor, and because I knew nothing of big house interiors and life, and brought to that interior and view only an imagination fed more by cartoons and films than by literature, I could think of no particular book with the setting, and because in an unfamiliar setting in England I fell into my old way of accepting or categorizing what I found as another example of English life, I thought that the Phillipses were examples of staff or servants living in the staff quarters of a biggish house. I attributed to them the manners of such people. It was disappointing to me to learn, as I did after a few months, that the Phillipses had come to the manor less than a year before me, that their manners were not the manners of servants or household staff, but simply their own manners, the manners of people looking for peace and relishing the peace they had found at the manor. Though they looked settled in the quiet of the manor, and though they were of the region, they were not country people, but people of the town, with country town tastes. Though they seemed to be absolutely part of the manor, at ease in their quarters and indifferent to the dereliction around them, as though that had come so slowly they had not noticed, they were in fact rootless people, less rooted than Jack over the hill. They had no house of their own, were planning for none. They lived in houses that went with the jobs they took, and though they were people nearing 50, as I thought, they seemed unconcerned about the time when they would be too old to work. Like their employer, my landlord, Mr. and Mrs. Phillips appeared to think that there would always be shelter for them. The car, the outings, the shopping in any one of the 3 or 4 towns that were near to us, the visits 2 or 3 times a week to a pub they knew well in any one of those towns, these were their pleasures. Town pleasures, not country pleasures, and that appearance of being long settled and comfortable in their quarters, where the furniture, most of it, would have belonged to the manor, that appearance which so reassured and comforted me that first day was part of their talent as rootless people. It was a talent not unlike Jack's, though it was not so immediately apparent. In the middle of farmyard dereliction and his own insecurity in his job and cottage, Jack kept his elaborate gardens, and did his digging for vegetables and flowers, and kept his plots in good heart. So, in the middle of an equal insecurity, since at any time their employer might die and they would have to move on with their possessions to another job and another set of rooms, the Phillipses made their cosy home. Jack was anchored by the seasons and the corresponding labours of his gardens. The Phillipses had a different kind of stability. It was events outside their home, festivities outside that gave rhythm and pattern and savour to their townish life, the outings, the visit two or three times a week to their pub, their annual holiday in the same hotel in the south. Probably this aspect of their life would have given the Phillipses away. They were not, by social habits, people of the village. They were not, by instinct or character, servants of a big house. They were people of the town, the outer world. And if I had been told nothing at all, Mrs. Phillips's pruning of the old rose bed in the garden would have made me wonder about them. Such roses in the summer in that rosebush wilderness. And then in the autumn the bushes had been cut down to thick, knotted stumps a few inches high, and Mrs. Phillips had often spoken of what she had done. "I've cut them right back," asserting so many things at once, boasting of her attempt to tame the wilderness at the back of the house, liking at the same time the severe business of cutting right back, and intending some slight rebuke to Pitten, the solitary gardener, who might so easily, had he been interested, had he really cared, have done the pruning she had had to do herself. There were no more roses. In the next summer there was only briar, a rampant, flowerless thicket. Briar swallowed the evidence of Mrs. Phillips's pruning, and she never mentioned it again, did nothing further in the manor gardens while Pitten was there. And perhaps when the cycle of the manor has truly ended, when everybody who knew the place then has disappeared, and new people with new plans walk about the grounds, that wild briar patch will be noted as proof of what can happen to untended, unpruned roses. Where, as a new arrival, accepting everything, I had seen people exemplifying their roles, soon it was the ambiguity of the Phillipses that made an impression caught in my mind. They were people of the outer world acting out their role as house servants, and the ambiguity was real. Mr. Phillips had been a male nurse in a mental hospital. Then he had worked in a hotel. In one of those places, a hospital or a hotel, Mrs. Phillips had begun to suffer from her nerves, and it was because of those nerves that they had come to the manor, to be a little withdrawn, to look after my landlord. So far from being a servant, Mr. Phillips had been in the business of restraining and disciplining people, and as often happens, people attracting people they need, Mr. Phillips, the strong man, attracted people, like his wife, with her nerves, whom he had to look after. And perhaps there was an extra happiness of this sort as well in his job in the house, with his employer, which would have explained his oddly happy, fulfilled look that day when I saw him driving his employer below the beeches on the ledge above the river. He was a man of medium height, perhaps even a small man. The cold weather clothes he wore, a heavy zip-up puller for the most part, concealed his physique. It was only in my second summer, perhaps because of what I had been told about him and what he had told me about himself, I noticed his well-developed back, his great shoulders and powerful forearms, as of a man used to lifting weights. Every afternoon at about 3 I heard him shout from somewhere beyond the vegetable garden. After some time I knew what he was shouting. He was shouting, "Fred!" It was his call to Pitten, to tea. Whether this was a gesture of friendship, whether it was something he was required to do, whether they all had tea together in the Phillips's sitting room or in the kitchen, or whether Pitten just went and took away his tea, I don't know. There was an irritation and authority in that shout that made me think of the other manor, as it was known locally, where Mr. Phillips, and Mrs. Phillips as well, before her nerves, had worked. Once there were 16 gardeners. Now there was only Pitten. It was some time, a fortnight perhaps, before I got to know him, got to know that he wasn't just a visitor to the grounds, and it was some time again before I understood that he was the gardener, the last of the legendary 16. He didn't quite fit the role. There was nothing antique or forlorn or elegiac about Pitten's appearance. He was in his mid-50s, middle-aged rather than old. He certainly wasn't one of the original 16. He was a sturdy man, with a firm paunch, and of the utmost respectability in his dress. He wore, it was winter when I first saw him, a felt hat, a three-piece tweed suit, and a tie. Always a tie on Pitten, winter and summer. Not only did he not look like one of the 16, he didn't even look like a gardener. At least he wasn't my idea of a gardener. And that is a better way of putting it, because this business of gardens and gardeners called up special Trinidad pictures and memories, called up the history of my own small Asiatic Indian community, late 19th-century peasant emigrants, and touched a nerve. As a child in Trinidad, I knew or saw few gardeners. In the country areas where the Indian people mainly lived, there were nothing like gardens. Sugarcane covered the land. Sugarcane, the old slave crop, was what the people still grew and lived by. It explained the presence on that island after the abolition of slavery of an imported Asiatic peasantry. Sugarcane explained the poor Indian-style houses and roughly thatched huts beside the narrow asphalt roads. In the smooth dirt yards of those little houses and huts, there were nothing like gardens. There might be hedges, mainly of hibiscus, lining the foul water ditches. There might be flower areas, periwinkle, Ixara zinnia, marigold, lady's slipper, with an occasional flowering small tree like the one we called the Queen of Flowers. There were seldom more. There were gardens in Port of Spain, but only in the richer areas, where the building plots were bigger. It was in those gardens that as a child, on my way home from school in the afternoons, I might see a barefoot gardener. And he would be less a gardener, really, less a man with knowledge about soils and plants and fertilizers than a man who was, more simply, a worker in a garden, a weeder and a waterer, a barefoot man, trousers rolled up to mid-shin, playing a hose on a flower bed. This barefoot gardener would be Indian. Indians were thought to have a special way with plants and the land, and this man might have been born in India and brought out to Trinidad on a 5-year indenture, with a promise of a free passage back to India at the end of that time, or a grant of land in Trinidad. This kind of Indian contract labour had ended only in 1917. Antiquity to me in 1940, say. But to the barefoot waterer in the garden, still perhaps knowing only a language of India, a time within easy recall. This kind of gardening was a town occupation, barely above, perhaps even merging into that of yard boy, which was an occupation for black people and something so unskilled and debased that the very words were used as a form of abuse. After the war, a new kind of agriculture began to develop. Port of Spain had grown, and the lands of the Aranjuez estate, not far from Port of Spain, were taken out of sugarcane cultivation. Aranjuez, named in the late 18th century by the Spaniards, after the town of Aranjuez in Spain, with the famous royal gardens. There was a certain amount of house-building at Aranjuez, but to the south, on the edge of what was swampland liable to flooding from the Gulf of Paria when the Orinoco River in Venezuela rose, on this land, on either side of the highway embankment, the Americans had built during the war. Former estate workers had leased plots from the estate, a few acres each, and had begun to develop vegetable gardens, slowly redeeming the land from swamp, building it up. The vegetables they grew, aubergines, beans, okras, had a shorter cycle than sugarcane, and they were correspondingly more demanding. They required finer attentions, and every day during a vegetable cycle, the vegetable growers could be seen weeding or digging, or watering, or spraying, even when there was horse racing, or an international cricket match in Port of Spain, or some big festive event, working the way men work only when they work for themselves. Cocoa created the effect of a forest or wood. Sugarcane was a tall grass. The straight lines of these vegetable plots, the human scale, the many different shades and textures of green gave us a new idea of agriculture and almost a new idea of landscape and natural beauty. The vegetable growers were Indian, but these vegetable plots were like nothing in peasant India. The skills, the practices, came from the experimental plots of the Imperial College of Tropical Agriculture, famous throughout the British Empire, which was just a mile or two away. Many of the Indian vegetable growers had worked there as garden labourers, and it was only some years after I had been in England that I saw that the landscape the Indian vegetable growers had created on either side of the highway in South Aranjuez, a landscape which had no pattern in Trinidad or India, was like the allotments I saw in England at the edge of towns from the railway train. English allotments in a tropical and colonial setting, created by accident and not by design, created at the end of the period of empire out of the decay of the old sugar plantations. 30 years later, the Aranjuez vegetable plots were to cover many square miles, land built up from swamp, season by season, creating a flat, wide Dutch effect, extending all the way to swamp mangrove in one direction and in the other appearing to go to the foot of the Trinidad Northern Range, now no longer green and empty, but covered on its lower slopes with the shacks of illegal black immigrants from the other islands, the landscape which, when I was a child, still retained some of its aboriginal pre-discovery features, was to be irrevocably altered, and the people with it. 30 years later, at the time of the oil boom, many of those vegetable growers, or their descendants, were to become people of wealth, with children at schools or universities in Canada and the United States. But at the beginning, just after the war, when there were still damp, palm-thatched huts in the aboriginal reeds and sedge of the swamp beside the American-built highway, the labour of those vegetable plots, scientific though it was, still looked brutish and underpaid, an extension of plantation life, of mud and sun and bare feet, damp huts and oily or sweated felt hats folded at the back to fit the head like a visored cap. Flowers were beautiful. Everyone loved them. In Port of Spain there were the many acres of the Royal Botanical Gardens, established after the British conquest of the island, and the lily ponds and rockeries of the rock gardens. Both places were recognised beauty spots, but the idea of gardeners was not contained in the idea of the garden. In fact, it ran contrary to the idea of the garden. The garden spoke of Port of Spain and comfort and a good office job and Sunday drives around the Queen's Park Savannah. The gardener belonged to the plantation or estate past. That past lay outside Port of Spain, in the Indian countryside, in the fields, the roads, the huts. Literature, or the cinema, though I cannot think of any particular film, would have given the word different associations. But that knowledge of swamp and estate and vegetable plot was the knowledge I took to England. That was the knowledge that lay below my idea of the P.G. Woodhouse gardener and my idea of the gardener in Richard II, poetically conversing with a weeping queen. And inevitably I acquired new knowledge. There were the gardeners of the great parks of London. There was the gardener of my Oxford college, a mild, humorous, pipe-smoking man with, as I thought, the manner of one of the dons. And just as in the allotments beside the railway I had grown to see the original of the Aranjuez plots, so coming to the manor, with its echoes of the estate, big house and servants, and seeing around me the remnants of agricultural life, the remote, distorted original of the Trinidad estates, that earlier knowledge revived in me. But Pitten, the last of the legendary 16, was quite original. He appeared at 9 every morning at the wide, white-painted gate at the end of the lawn, and in his three-piece tweed suit he looked so unlike a gardener, or any sort of manual worker. He so studiously avoided looking at my cottage, so carefully kept his distance, kept to the far path, that I thought he was going on through the back of the manor grounds to some quite different duties, and in opening the white gate was simply exercising some old public right of way. There was a certain amount of movement in and out of the manor grounds, and until his punctuality and regularity gave him away, I thought that Pitten might be one of those visitors, someone perhaps approaching the farmyard or the churchyard from a back way, and someone also with a right to use the water tap near the garden shed, at the side of the squash court built like a farmhouse. We also had animal visitors. There was a black-and-white cat that came down the way Pitten came, and, in the tall grass and weeds near the box hedge, became a great hunter. There was a Labrador dog that made an opposite circuit. He belonged to a house further up the valley. His master was away in London during the week, and on weekday mornings this dog did its own circuit of the water meadows. On sunny mornings from my sitting-room I saw his tail bouncing up and down far away. Saw no more. Until eventually, having pushed through water meadow and overgrown orchard, the animal fetched up in front of my cottage, underbelly black and wet, paws black and wet. Like Pitten, he stuck close to the buildings on the other side of the lawn, and there was in his hunched shoulders, his looking straight ahead, a little like Pitten trying to give the assurance that he was minding his own business, some hint that he knew he was in territory not his own. The elegant fawn-coloured creature was not liked by everybody. His morning circuit was not of the water meadows alone. He was also a haunter of dustbins. The Phillipses at the manor complained. Even Pitten complained. A disappointment there about the dog. A little like the disappointment I felt in Pitten himself, when he, the carefully dressed, paunchy, staid figure, became known to me and turned out to be only the gardener. The wilderness that the black and white cat and the fawn-coloured Labrador explored was the wilderness that claimed Pitten, or so it seemed, the wilderness which he entered every day as gardener. But he never came out as dirty or as wet as the Labrador. He came out as clean as the cat. The main reason was his steadiness, his refusal to hurry himself. Pitten knew how to pace himself. There was nothing in Pitten's labour of the attack or boisterousness of Jack when I saw him in his allotment or garden. On some summer afternoons, Jack worked bare-backed. Pitten would never have done that. Pitten cared too much for the idea of clothes. If Jack's varied labours and varied dress, as I saw them in his after-hours garden, were like successive illuminations in a book of hours, exaggerated and emblematic, Pitten was a more modern man, a man of fashion. Yet in Pitten's fashionableness, his careful but regular buying of clothes that matched the seasons and were meant for that season's wear, in this very steadiness, this absence of waste, there was something like ritual. Clothes and the seasons ritualized Pitten's year. There was a time for the felt hat and the three-piece suit, thorn-proof. There was a time for the straw hat. There was a time when the three-piece suit became a two-piece. There was a time for pullovers. One pullover, two pullovers. There was a time for country shirts, a time for lighter shirts, a time for a quilted jacket, a time for a dark, thin plastic raincoat. His dress was absolutely suited to the work he was doing and the time of year. In that fine judgment about clothes and the weather, as well as in his steadiness, his physical pacing of himself, lay Pitten's extraordinary neatness. And in his clothes, his appearance, his refusal to look like a gardener or farm worker, a labourer, lay much of his pride. I thought that at least some of the vanity would have been given Pitten by his wife. She was a woman of a great, delicate beauty which was extraordinary in someone of her station. Her complexion and features, and her carriage, suggested the nearness of some fine strain. Both Pitten and his wife were people without the gift of words. They had trouble finding words for what they had to say, so it seemed that they had very little to say. But the beauty of Pitten's wife was of such a sort that it overcame her intellectual, which was also her social, disability. It was always good to see her. Her near dumbness was always a surprise. Beauty is beauty, though, and beauty is rare. No one who possesses it can be indifferent to it. And I thought that Pitten's clothes were meant, either by Pitten himself or by his wife, to match, to set off, Mrs. Pitten's looks. Then another idea was given me by a middle-aged English writer, a friend for many years, who was visiting one day. As a writer, he was socially scrupulous, knowing how, in England, to look through both the caricature and the self-caricature. The writer saw Pitten. It was summer now, and Pitten was in his summer clothes, with his straw hat, picking his way back slowly to the white gate. Pitten's morning work was done. He was going home for lunch. He timed his lunchtime exit so that he would reach the white gate more or less at 1 o'clock. Pitten was on the far side of the lawn, not looking at my windows, staring ahead like the fawn-coloured Labrador. Tony said, "Is that your landlord?" "He's the gardener." Tony said, "It proves something I've long held. People get to look like their employees." I hadn't truly seen my landlord, and didn't know what he looked like. Tony had perhaps seen him years before in London, in the days when my landlord was socially active, a man about town, before he had withdrawn. But Pitten's resemblance to my landlord, if such a resemblance did exist, couldn't have been induced in the way Tony was suggesting. The employee imitating the employer, and the employer then, out of laziness, out of being flattered, imitating the imitation of his employee. Pitten's resemblance to my landlord would have been an accident, a coincidence, because Pitten had come to the manor at about the time my landlord had withdrawn, at the beginning of my landlord's Great Depression. Even now, as I heard from the Phillipses, my landlord came out of his room only on the finest days, and Pitten hardly saw him. It was the Phillipses who mediated between my landlord and the gardener, or, more properly, the garden. My landlord couldn't have been Pitten's model. But I felt at once that there was something in what Tony had said or implied about Pitten, that the style was modelled on that of a superior. Pitten, as I heard, had been in the army in some capacity before coming to the manor. We were in a military area, and turning over this question of Pitten's model after Tony's visit, In fact, never losing the idea as long as I saw Pitten, it came to me that Pitten's model, with the encouragement of Mrs. Pitten, would have been an army officer of 20 or 25 years before, whom Pitten had served or served under. Someone still alive in Pitten's memory. Pitten's imitation, this officer's chief memorial, perhaps. The army was still important to Pitten. His son was in the army. The progress or the postings of this boy was the only topic which could make Mrs. Pitten, blinking fast, speak a sentence or two. Normally she only smiled and looked pretty. We met occasionally at the bus stop, in the shade of the dark yews and beeches. There were not many buses. The road was fairly quiet, and voices at the bus stop sounded and echoed almost as in a room. We spoke about her son as though he were no more than a boy at school, as though, say, he was doing reasonably well with the books, but doing a little better in the swimming and the sports. The word school did in fact come up in Mrs. Pitten's talk of her son's army life. She told me at the bus stop one day, "They've sent him to the artillery school." This would have been at Larkhill. Apt name, once. These downs around Stonehenge rang at the appropriate season with lark song, but now, untouched, though the green downs looked, Larkhill was the name of the Army Artillery School, booming away during the day and sometimes during the night, and sometimes, if there was a big exercise, night and day. Because Pitten's son was there, and because Pitten told me of the great event, I went in my first summer to the artillery school's open day. It was like one of the summer rowing occasions at Oxford, when the families of undergraduates occupied the college barges. It was like the sports day at my school, Queen's Royal College, in colonial Trinidad. I recognized the occasion at once. Instead of masters and boys, there were officers and soldiers. Instead of sports, displays with guns, displays of great skill. But there was the same atmosphere of the fair, of food and women's clothes, of unusual colours, of normally hidden family relationships now publicly exposed. The same half-humorous loudspeaker announcements, the same atmosphere of dressing up and showing off, the same atmosphere of a society especially mixed for that day. Boys and masters showing off at the school sports, men and officers showing off here, whole families showing off. Women and girls displaying themselves, the poorer very concerned not to be outfaced. I could see the attraction of the occasion for the Pittens. I could see that it might well have been their most important social occasion for the year, and the open day did provide a little extra conversation for a while with Mrs. Pitten at the bus stop. Then she told me one day that her son had finished his training at the artillery school. It had gone well. His friends gave him a little memento. And believing, perhaps, that memento might be an army word, another special army word as new and puzzling to me as it had been to her, she repeated it and explained it. A little memento of his time with them, an old-fashioned brass cannon set in clear plastic, like a diamond. A cheap souvenir. The smiling, empty-faced woman speaking of her son as of a child still. The memento, the bad art, the reality, the army, the soldier's son, should have matched. But the reality was different. The reality was serious. The Pitten boy was being trained as a killer soldier, the new-style British soldier, and he was suited to the part. He was a giant with very big feet. The fineness of the strain that had produced Mrs. Pitten's features had ended with her, or had skipped her son. It was astonishing that now, after its ineptitude in the 19th century, which was yet the century of the great glory of the Empire, and after its great but wasting achievements in the Second World War, at the end of that imperial glory, it was astonishing that now, when there were no more big wars for the country to fight, the British Army should be concentrating on producing this kind of elite soldier. There were occasional incidents in the little towns around Salisbury Plain. The taxi drivers sometimes had trouble at night, but in our valley, we seldom saw a soldier or an army vehicle. Army vehicles seemed not to be allowed there. In our valley we lived protected from what surrounded us, just as in the 19th century the big industrialists lived in country estates, outside the industrial towns where they made their fortunes. Pitten's boy came home one weekend with his girl. On Sunday afternoon he took her up to the viewing point. That was when I saw them. I was coming down the hill at the end of my own walk. The small girl clung to the giant, seeming to wrap herself around him in a demonstrative way I had never seen in the valley. or it might have been that I was at the age when I was able to observe these things with detachment. The detachment and knowingness I was aiming at when I was 18 and doing my drafts of Gala Night. The boy, the girl, the parents' house, the walk before tea, the tribal ritual, setting the observer at a distance. But how disquieting that boy's face was. In spite of his size, one could see the child his mother still saw, the unformed features still, the conflation of the two gentle faces, Pittens and Mrs. Pittens, the two simple, inarticulate people I knew, inarticulate but with their own vanities, the two faces meeting in the dangerous obedience, the new vanity of the soldier. It was this quality of obedience in Pitten, the obedience he had passed on to his soldier son, that separated him from Jack. Over the hill, in a kind of no-man's land, beside the droveway and the half-abandoned farmyard, Jack did more or less what Pitten did in the wilderness of the manor grounds. But Jack was free in a way Pitten wasn't, and now could never be. Perhaps it was Jack's intellectual backwardness, his purely physical nature, that made him content with what he had. And that was not little. Jack was lucky in his circumstances, his cottage, the land he could till, and above all his isolation, the silence and solitude he went to sleep in and woke up to. These circumstances, taken together, made his backwardness unimportant, and not the burden it might so easily have been in another place. These circumstances of Jack's, together with the nature of a man, made his life appear like a constant celebration. That labour in his garden, after his paid work on the farm, that exhaustion, the pleasures then of food, and the drive to the pub, the long, muzzying drinks, the sight year after year of the sweet, or beautiful, and profitable fruits of his labour. Why not, then, the bare back in the summer as much as the fire in winter? There was a relish, and a boisterousness, and a toughness to Jack that neither Pitten nor his son would ever now have. The soldier's boisterousness, of which Pitten's son was no doubt capable, was perhaps like the boisterousness of the undergraduates in the cellar of my Oxford college before dinner, a form of caste behaviour, something acquired, as unnatural as formal manners. Pitten wouldn't have cared for the brutishness and constriction of Jack's life, farm, cottage, garden, pub, all within a few miles. Pitten was more intelligent, had seen more. He had models where Jack had none. Pitten expected more for himself. He wished to offer more to his wife, of whose beauty, though I never heard him speak of it or hint of it, he would have been proud. But the superior intelligence and knowledge which made Pitten ambitious also made him obedient and vulnerable, put his life in the hands of others. So there was something in the simple first impression Pitten made on me, observing him enter the grounds by the white gate every morning at 9. He didn't look like a gardener. With his felt hat and tweed suit, he looked more like a visitor, like a man passing through. He was in fact going to the garden shed, which was also his changing room. He entered in his suit, a visitor, he emerged a gardener, having adapted his garb to the weather and job of the morning. But he had no idea of himself as the last of the legendary 16. He had another idea of himself, another idea of romance, and although, as we were to see, when the time came, he valued his job on the manor and the freedom of his job, he was unsupervised and could work out his contracted hours as he chose. And although it was in his power to turn a blind eye to poachers, or even some local gentleman looking for a little Saturday afternoon shooting, although in outsiders' eyes a little of the grandeur and privilege of the manor attached to Pitten, the manor formed no part of Pitten's idea of romance. And that was disappointing to me, that on the manor Pitten, like the Phillipses and like me, was a camper in the ruins, living with what he found, delighted by the evidence of the life of the past, like a barbarian coming upon an ancient Roman villa in Gloucestershire, momentarily delighted by the wonder and ruin of a heating system he no longer understood or needed, like a barbarian in North Africa, brushing away new desert sand from a mosaic floor with gods now as mysterious and unnecessary as the craft of the mosaic floor itself, once hawked about by merchants travelling with patterns, stones and journeyman floor layers, but not tormented in any romantic way by the idea of that life, not wishing to recreate or restore. It was Pitten who, after he had cut away through the orchard and woodland undergrowth to the garden refuge area, had shown me the thatched two-story children's house, one of the refinements of the grounds, yet by its appearance never much used by children, more an adult refinement, a piece of period fantasy and elegance. Pitten understood that and thought the children's house worth showing. But the garden refuge he had created over the years, especially melancholy with faded flowers and discarded flower arrangements, not all from the manor, some from the funerals in the little church that spoke of death and the rituals of farewell. This refuge of Pitten's was just behind the children's house. The house, in fact, with its high conical roof, served to hide the dump and made it more of a refuge. But if Pitten were not as equable as he was, if he couldn't live easily with the idea of ruin, if he had been one of the original 16 and had been weakened by elegiac fantasies, he might not have been able to do what he did do. That summer, my first, word came down from his employer, my landlord, that the hidden garden was to be opened up and cleaned. Hidden? Was there something in the grounds, apart from the lawn and the wood and the walks at the other side of the house that were for the exclusive use of my landlord, that I didn't know? There was. The hidden garden, as it turned out, was so successfully hidden that, though I walked past it every day, I had never suspected that there was anything unusual there. It was a trick, like false books on a shelf. It was at the back of the main garage, and what looked just like the vegetable garden wall at the back of the garage was, in fact, the outer wall of the hidden garden. Behind that outer wall, and the true wall of the vegetable garden, was the hidden garden. It was enclosed on all sides and entered by a wooden door. This door, which I passed every day, was permanently shut and seemed from the outside to be one of the many doors or gates to the vegetable garden, which, with a diminution of staff, the thinning away of the 16, had been closed forever. That door was now opened, and Pitten went to work, carting away barrow-loads of old, wet, dead leaves flattened by their own weight, and earth mingled with old beech-mast. I noticed then his precise way with the loaded wheelbarrow, before pushing it off. He stationed himself carefully, and then, holding his arms straight down after a pause, bent his knees, so that in the process of holding and raising the handles of the barrow, his back remained more or less straight. It made me think that this was probably how the men who carried sedan chairs in the 18th century handled their bodies, to prevent ache or damage. Barrow-load after barrow-load Pitten carted to the refuge, and in the hidden garden below the tall, spindly-branched blossom trees there came up, almost as new, a little tiled fountain, the tiles pale blue with spangles of gold. A frivolity, a little extra, a gilding of the lily, a little something else to do when all had already been done, something from the 20s or early 30s. The Phillipses called me to witness. Pitten called me to witness. We exclaimed, all of us, dutifully, at the secretness of the garden. The Phillipses exclaimed that something so beautiful could be so neglected. We all exclaimed that so many people had walked past the place without knowing, and we felt we were a little privileged, seeing what we did. But then no one seemed to know what to do with the hidden garden. The door was closed, the garden and the tiled fountain became secret again, and no doubt soon began to be covered again by the debris of leaves and beech-mast and dead beech twigs. The fantasy of a summer for my landlord. Something one day, some quality of light, some object in the house, some letter, might have reminded him of that garden of his childhood. He wanted to see it. He sent down instructions. Pitten worked for a week, and when he had seen it, he forgot about it again. Had he seen it, though? Had he walked so far from his usual protected beat? Had he come so close to my cottage, and what he would have considered the public part of the grounds? I never heard from Mr. or Mrs. Phillips that my landlord had actually gone to have a look. What had disappointed me no longer disappointed me. Pitten couldn't do the job he did, couldn't work with the knowledge that his labour was eventually to be wasted or mocked, couldn't keep a kind of order, couldn't hold back utter vegetable decay. If the glory of the old manor garden and the grounds had been part of his romance, if he had been one of the legendary 16. Pitten could do what he did because he had his outside, army or army officer fantasy. And as a result, perhaps because of resentment of this outside life, this self-sufficiency of Pittance, or perhaps because of resentment of his manner and pretensions, the idea that was put about was that, in the business of gardening, Pitten didn't really know. He grew vegetables and certain kinds of flowers that were required by the house, and that meant his employer. But somehow, in spite of this, he didn't really know, wasn't a true gardener, a man who possessed the mystery. And in this rebuke or resentment of Pitten, there was contained an idea of the gardener which I felt to be very old, going beyond the idea of the gardener which I had found at my Oxford college, going back to the beginning of worship and the idea of fertility, the idea even of the god of the node. The gardener is the man who caused the unremarkable seed to grow into leaves, stalks, buds, flowers, fruit, called this all up from the seed, where it has lain in small. The gardener as magician, herbalist, in touch with the mystery of seed and root and graft, which, with the mystery of cooking, is one of the earliest mysteries that the child discovers, one of the earliest mysteries that I, my sister, and my cousins discovered, when in the hard yellow earth of our Port of Spain yard we, taking example one from the other, and just for the sake of the magic, planted hard, dry corn, maize, three seeds in a shallow hole, fenced the hole round with a little palisade of sticks, to protect it from the chickens that ran free in the yard, and then, 3 days later, in the morning, before going to school, discovered the miracle, the maize shoots that morning breaking the earth, the green outer sheath developing quickly into a thin leaf, curling back on itself like a blade of grass, like sugar cane, developing until the child became bored, ceased to watch and protect, and the chickens knocked the stick palisade down and pecked the still tender plant down to nothing. It was this childhood sensation, this childhood delight in making things grow, that was touched in England when I saw the vegetable allotments at the edge of towns, beside the railway tracks. I attributed to the people who worked in those allotments something of what I felt as a child when I planted my corn seeds, felt it as old, that emotion, that need, surviving here in England, the first industrial country, surviving in the hearts of dwellers in the ugliest and most repetitive Victorian industrial towns, surviving like the weeds that grow in the artificial light and polluted air of railway terminals, growing in the oily gravel between the rails almost against the buffers. That instinct to plant, to see crops grow, might have seemed eternal, something to which the human heart would want to return. But in the plantation colony from which I came, a colony created for agriculture, for the growing of a particular crop, created for the great flat fields of sugarcane, which were the point and explanation of everything, the houses, the style of government, the mixed population, in that colony, created by the power and wealth of industrial England, the instinct had been eradicated. The vegetable fields of Aranjuez, in Trinidad, on either side of the American highway, had been created by accident, with the debris, the accidental diffusion among labourers of the learning of the Imperial College of Tropical Agriculture. They looked like the allotments in England, and there was a connection of learning, of science, but the plots of Aranjuez at the edge of Port of Spain and the allotments at the edge of English towns spoke of different instincts, needs, different hearts now. The old world of planting and fertility, the very early world, perhaps existed in the colony, and only for a short time, in the child's heart. Adult eyes saw in agriculture not magic, but servitude and ugliness. And that was why the English allotments touched something as small and as far away and as vague as my memory of planting three seeds of corn in the yard of our family house in Port of Spain. The idea that Pitten didn't know was something in the air at the manor. It was an idea that came to me gradually, with knowledge of my surroundings. I do not remember Mr. or Mrs. Phillips offering it as a statement, so I suppose that the idea would have been put to me in a number of indirect ways by the Phillipses before I had settled in and learned to look around me and come to my own judgments. I assumed, for instance, that it was because of this idea that Pitten didn't know, that Mrs. Phillips in my first autumn, and really, as I was to understand, not long after she herself had come to work and live at the manor, cut back the old overgrown moss rose bushes in the overgrown rose garden and reduced them to rampant briar. When the spring came and the true rose leaves didn't show among the seven-leaved briar stems and the thorny rosebuds didn't appear, she said nothing. She dropped the subject of the roses and the pruning. It was one of my early lessons in the valley in the idea of change, of things declining from the perfection, as I thought, in which I had found them. And though every May for some years afterwards, when I was there, I looked for those buds in spite of the briar, hoping for magic, this silence about the roses was for me a way of coping with the disappearance of the roses. What was perfection to me would have been decay to the people before me, and hardly conceivable to the first designers or gardeners. Nothing more about the roses, then. But by this time Pitten had been given his character, and increasingly I felt it as odd that this resentment of Pitten as a man with an insufficient grasp of his mysterious craft, a man without the true vocation, should come from people, the Phillipses in the manor, and Bray, Pitten's immediate neighbour, none of whom could be said to have vocations or trades, people who, for this reason, in this agricultural, non-industrial part of England, were curiously unanchored, floating. The Phillipses I thought of as people getting by. It was impressive to me, who had lived all my life with anxiety and ambition, to discover that they had no plans for their future, had almost no idea of that future, had planned for nothing, and lived with the assumption that somehow, should things go wrong here, there would always be a kind of job with quarters for them somewhere else. It was impressive to me, and I don't mean it ironically, this readiness for change, for living with what came. But it contained no idea of the vocation or achievement. It contained only this idea of getting by, of lasting, of seeing one's days out. And the same was true of Bray, Pitten's neighbour. Bray was a car-hire man, and though he was more rooted than anyone in the village, and was as close to the manor as anyone could be, his father had worked in the manor in the old days, he who rebuked Pitten for not knowing about gardens had so little feeling for gardens, and even for the valley in which he lived, that he had turned all the front part of his house plot into a concrete area for his various always-changing vehicles. The Phillipses, who gave Pitten tea every day, the cry of Fred from Mr. Phillips had tones of authority rather than friendship or fellowship, made no direct statements about Pitten to me. Bray wasn't like that. Bray was more open. It was his independent style. He was proud of this style. He was open about my landlord. He wished that openness to be noted. He said, raising the topic himself, "Wouldn't have him in the car, like a bloody bird. Wants to sit in the front. Then he wants to sit in the back. Then he wants to sit in the front again." And of Pitten Bray said more than once, "He's a very arrogant man." Arrogant, like communist, was one of Bray's words. Arrogant was primarily Bray's version of ignorance, but it also had the meaning of arrogant, and this word, when used by Bray with its two meanings and aggressive sound, was very strong. Pitten and Bray lived in adjoining semi-detached cottages on the public road. The cottages had slate roofs and walls of flint and red brick, with the brick in regular two-course bands. Both cottages had once belonged to the manor, and like the picturesque thatched cottages not far away, like the manor itself, had been built by the manor estate before the First World War. Pitten's cottage still belonged to the manor. The cottage went with the job, but Bray owned his cottage. He had inherited it from his father, who had worked all his life at the manor, and had bought the cottage for very little. The sale was in the nature of a benefaction to him, when the manor estate had begun to shrink, the family being active elsewhere. The smallness, sturdiness, the straight lines and the materials, red or orange-coloured brick and flint, had made me think of those cottages as semi-urban. But then, getting my eye in, I had seen the style in old farm buildings for many miles around, had seen it as the local way with flint, which was so plentiful here, and I had grown to understand that the cottages had been built as experimental, improved agricultural cottages. They were as a result more genuinely period now than the thatched cottages just down the road. The thatched cottage still stood for an idea of the rural picturesque, and thatching was far from being a vanishing skill. Thatchers were at work in all the valleys of Wiltshire, but the building style of the improved cottages, the flint and the bands of brick, was no longer practised by the local masons. That particular skill with flint was hard to come by, and the social idea of improving cottages for agricultural workers no longer had a point. Similar houses, then, for Bray and Pitten, houses with an easily readable past. But on Bray's side of the party wall and fence, there was the idea of proprietorship. Bray owned his house. He wanted that to be known, and to that he added the idea that he was a free man, a man who worked for himself. On Pitten's side there was the idea of style. Pitten kept a tidy garden with a hedge, a patch of lawn, and small flowering trees. Bray's garden was more a concrete yard for his cars and minibuses.